You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. I'm really excited for this podcast. It's with James Kimmel Jr., who is an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at the Yale School of Medicine. He's also the founder and co-director of the Yale Collaborative for Motive Control Studies, and a researcher, lawyer, and an author who focuses on neuroscience, psychology, revenge, addiction, forgiveness, and violence. He has a new book. It's called The Science of Revenge, Understanding the World's Deadliest Addiction and How to Overcome It. Enjoy the pod. James Kimmel Jr., welcome to the podcast.
Kelly, thanks for having me.
I want to start with a story of mine because I think it fits the book. And this happened 20 some odd years ago, maybe even 30 years ago. And when, as a young man, I had a sort of perilous relationship to road rage. And I was driving to Second City in the morning, and I'm pulled up at this intersection on Lincoln Avenue, right by where the Luminati's is, across from a park. People in Chicago will know where I'm talking about. And a guy pulls up next to me, and he's revving his engines, and I can tell what's going to happen. We're at a red light, and he's going to try to shoot in front of me, and I don't want this to happen for whatever reason. And so I gun it, and he can't get by me. And clearly furious is this human being. So they're behind me, but I see them come into oncoming traffic, the other lane, and pull to cut me off, but they lose control of their car and they literally smash into a coffee shop into the front door.
Oh.
So I'm like kind of freaking out about the whole thing, wondering what just happened, why did I do what I did, all those things. I get to the office, I call my wife immediately and I explain to her what happened. She goes, yeah, Kel, they're actually talking about this on WBEZ radio right now. And this guy's sort of explaining that some guy had road rage on him. He wasn't doing anything. And that was a moment in which I'm not going to say I haven't had road rage, but I have controlled the impulse and I have pretty much not done what I did or anywhere close to that ever before. And your book seems to be kind of about this, and where this goes really bad.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I've been the driver of your car. I've also been the driver of that guy's car. Although yes. I have not actually crashed into a coffee shop.
No, you came close though.
Yeah, I did. I came very close. I came very, very close. Much, much more dangerous situation for me. You know, I describe in the book as a teenager, maybe a little younger than you, coming to the point within actual seconds of committing a revenge-fueled mass shooting, and being able at the last second to pull away from that. But then, you know, diving into a career as a professional revenge seeker, aka a lawyer, you know, as a litigator, getting paid to do this for your clients, on the legalized version of that being justice seeking rather than revenge. So legalized revenge.
So it's so interesting reading through this book. I don't know that I've ever read a book about the science of revenge. So the title, of course, hooked me in. This is why I want you on the podcast. And I was thinking about this because I just booked, my wife and I are going to visit our son who lives in Atlanta, who is a Shakespearean actor. And I'm thinking about every production I've seen him in, and he's in McBee, is like, this is all about revenge.
All revenge.
and then I started thinking about like, isn't all theater all about, now, not everything, but a lot is about revenge. So the artists, the poets,
the playwrights, they've been talking about this. They've been showing us this. And yet, why have we not studied it?
You know, I think that we haven't studied it because, first of all, we haven't had the tools, right? I mean, the tools that we have now, pretty powerful, amazing stuff to see inside your skull. When you have a grievance and are given the opportunity to think about plot and actually get revenge, those tools just haven't existed until the last, 30, 40 years. People have only been studying that for the last 20, and only the last 10 has that study gotten intense enough so that we can make us and voluminous enough so that we can make some conclusions about what's going on. And it turns out that your brain on revenge looks like your brain on drugs.
Okay. So this is the major thesis of the book. I wasn't bought in at the beginning. I got bought in by the end. But you brought this up as essentially a layperson, right? This idea of revenge as an addiction and got sort of shot down, but not everyone. Some people were intrigued, and that's a journey for you that goes through a book. But let's just talk a little bit about this main thesis, this idea that revenge is a kind of addiction.
Yeah. So, neurologically speaking, when I say your brain on revenge looks like your brain on drugs, what we're able to see are neuroscientists, more than 60 neuroscientists at universities around the world have seen, is that if you give a study participant inside a brain scanner a grievance and an opportunity to retaliate against the person who wronged them. And this started out as economic games, for instance, in which people were cheating in economic game scenarios. So there wasn't any kind of violence or even pseudo violence in those early studies. But what we see is that as a person is experiencing this grievance and thinking about retaliating, that it's activating the same pleasure and reward circuitry of addiction that activates for drugs. In other words, we start thinking about craving and ultimately in some cases executing on revenge desires to make ourselves feel better, because the pain of our grievances, which are real or imagined perceptions of humiliation, shame, injustice, unfairness, victimization of any sort, those things are real and very painful, and our brain wants rid of that pain as fast as possible. And we've evolved so that we derive enormous pleasure, like drug-like dopamine high pleasure, from hurting the people who hurt us or their proxies.
You've been working on this for a while, right? Yeah. So you have decades of digging in on this. Could you ever imagine that you and I are sitting here today having this conversation about this book and what is going on in the world right now in the weeks that precede this conversation, which is on September 24th, 2025? Is maybe this concept is what is, I mean, people are shooting each other. People are, the discord on social media is off the chain. And all the studies show that when you actually talk to Americans, they don't want this war. And yet it appears that we kind of have one right now. And I know I come to work and I talk to my colleagues and we're exhausted by what's happening right now.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sadly, tragically fortuitous that my book came out in May of this year. And, this has been going on for some amount of time before that, but it's just getting more and more heated as we go along. And I think that if you sit back, even as a layperson, without any knowledge of the neuroscience, and look at what this behavior looks like, what you see are people who crave hurting other people and provoking them, and they're unable to stop that or control that. It makes them feel enormous highs, but they're temporary and they need to do it again and again and again. It seems to be habit forming. It seems to be compulsive and uncontrollable. And those are the very things we think about when we think about other addictions, right? It is, the standard definition, layperson's definition of addiction is the inability to resist an urge or a craving despite knowing the negative consequences. And is that not what we witness now on a day by day in America?
And this addiction is such a great equalizer in the sense that it is affecting to people who have no followers, no names. And it's the president of the United States and the richest man on earth, Elon Musk. Yeah. There's it's the behavior that, you know, is what you're saying, which is like, that's when it kicked in for me where I'm like, oh, this behavior does look like addict behavior. When I, you know, have known and worked with many addicts. Let's talk about some of these people and these stories that you tell, because they can illustrate some of the elements around the ideas. And you tell the story of, I might get her name wrong, Olga Hepnerova.
Right, right.
Who in 1973 drove a freight truck into a crowd of people in Prague. Tell us why you include her story in the book.
Yeah, I include her story because before she did that act, which resulted in the deaths of 8 people and injuries to many, many more people, most of whom were senior citizens gathered at a tram stop in Prague, just waiting to get on a tram. And she targeted them. But before she went on this murderous run, she had written letters to the editors of Prague newspapers explaining that she intended to do this and why. And she explained in detail the why was that she felt that she had been mistreated, victimized, humiliated, and shamed throughout her life, abused by her parents, classmates, teachers, all sorts of people, and that she wanted to get revenge against society. And the way that she went about this, it turns out, and this has never been analyzed this way, but it really became clear for me as I was studying her case and writing this book, she actually kind of put society and those people on trial inside a courtroom of her mind, in which she played all of the roles. She was the victim. She was the defendant. She was the judge and jury deciding, guilt or innocence in a sentence. She was the warden carrying out that sentence, which was death. And so she played all of these roles. And even though she was the perpetrator of this mass murder, she was in the days before it and leading up to it, the victim. And this is that insight that perpetrators are almost in all cases victims first inside their minds or in reality. They've been victimized in some way in their lives. And we see this with the shootings that have been happening recently, you know, the Annunciation Church case where the young man stood outside, church windows and shot and murdered children, at a church school in Minneapolis. The political killings recently of Charlie Kirk and Melissa Holman and all of these other cases. When you can identify what was happening, they all indicate that they felt wronged. That was their motive. And revenge, in other words, was their motive. And there is only one motive in all of these crimes, in almost all violent crimes. And yet we continually bother the police and go, what was the motive? And the police keep saying, I don't know, because the police aren't looking for a motive. They're looking for the grievance. What was the specific grievance that triggered this desire for revenge? And the point I raise in the book is that doesn't matter. There are almost an infinite number of grievances in the world, real or imagined, and even imagined grievances, things that you manufacture or that somebody manufactures for you, are enough to trigger real life revenge behavior, revenge violence, and revenge murder. So we can kind of set aside the grievances and quit focusing on them and start focusing on the brain biological process that converts a grievance into a desire to kill. And we now know what that process is. It's this desire for pleasure because we feel victimized, regardless of what the victimization was. It's not evil. They're not monstrous people. They're not, we're not talking about ghouls and creatures from another world that are unleashed on our planet. They're just all of us who experience victimization. And when we do, we quite naturally want to hurt the people who hurt us or their proxies.
Yeah. You bring up a couple mythbusters. One is like people aren't doing mass killings twice.
Right.
So, you know, like
not often. Right.
Not often.
Yeah.
And also that this idea, which permeated culture, which is they do it to become famous. I mean, there's a Peter Gabriel song about this.
Right.
And you point out, of course, that almost like most of these people don't survive the killing.
Right.
And then you yourself have tried to talk to some of these people and, you know, they don't want to talk about it.
Right. The idea that anyone, engages in mass murder for fame or popularity is a pretty outrageous and not supported idea, at least in neuroscience, right? I mean, that's not a motivation for people to kill. It's a motivation for people to strive. It may be, and I point out in the book, it could be a motivation to up the death toll. It could be a motivation to increase your pleasure from revenge seeking. But if there's no pleasure for revenge seeking, there's not going to be a mass shooting. If you're not seeking revenge, you're probably not killing anyone. You're not just one day going, I'd like to be famous. Maybe I'll kill 30 people. They're incongruous ideas. We usually seek fame because we want the adulation, not because we want it for 2 seconds before we're killed at our own hands by shooting ourselves in the head. It doesn't make sense.
The other thing that gets talked about all the time in these days is like, well, it's one mentally ill person.
Right.
Are these people, is there evidence that they're mentally ill?
That's an excellent question. And that depends on how you define mental illness. So up to, very recent times and including today, unfortunately, mental health professionals will say, no, there isn't evidence of a mental illness in the way we define mental illness in the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, this big, huge book that doctors use and define mental illnesses in. Things like schizophrenia and major depression and bipolar disorder and borderline personality, these things, that's true. They're right that those aren't the types of mental illnesses that drive people to kill. There is one form of mental illness that's not recognized, that needs to be recognized, and that's what this neuroscience shows in the book, and that would be called revenge use disorder, or revenge addiction is what I call it. That can be and should be classified as a mental illness, and if we do, we can then suddenly identify and take out of mystery and into the bright light, we can see people who are struggling with revenge desires and revenge cravings who need help and possibly help them before they act on them, or if after, then we can begin to treat them and help them recover from these revenge episodes that are so dangerous and that are, in effect, an illness. We call drug addiction a mental illness or a mental disorder, mental health disorder, and we call gambling the same thing. So why wouldn't we call this a mental health disorder as well, or a mental illness?
There's another character you study in the book, Michael Stokes, who is a former Navy cook who ended up murdering two people. And I think he's interesting in terms of the story itself, but then also because you were able to talk to him, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Where this human ended up and who this human being is now after doing this sort of horrific act. So can you take us through that story?
Yeah, Michael became infatuated with a woman at his place of employment, a restaurant where he was a cook at the restaurant. And she seemed to reciprocate interest in him and then stopped. And he was very frustrated and very concerned, and eventually learned that maybe she was seeing someone else at the restaurant, and this upset him, and he ended up joining the Navy to get away from the whole situation. But once he got there, he just wanted to come back, and he wanted to try and rekindle, and she seemed to welcome him at first and then pushed him away. Eventually, he got to the point that with this infatuation and her potential affair with a coworker, that he began thinking about ending his own life because he had had a lot of like a long chain of failures. He had kind of failed coming out of high school. He failed in college, kind of failed at the Navy. He failed as being a cook, and he placed, he put all of his money on this woman, and she was going to redeem him. And when she finally ultimately rejected him, that was such a piercing, intense wound for him that he thought, I'm going to have to end my life. He got guns to do that. But as he was planning his last day, he began to think about and imagine, and this is what I'm talking about in terms of manufactured victimization and grievance. He began to imagine that she and the guy that she was seeing, he began to see their reaction, and their reaction to his death as he saw it and imagined it was just complete scorn and contempt. And they were belittling him and making fun of him for killing himself. And this moved him from the desire to kill himself to the desire to kill those two and then himself. And he actually went to a restaurant and carried it out. And he afterward put the gun down, waited for the police, surrendered, admitted to the crime. He had done what he needed to do to, in that moment, make himself feel better and stop the pain. But now he's serving a 55-year sentence in jail. But yet in jail, just like he was before this happened, he was actually an exemplary kid in high school. And he has been an exemplary prisoner in the prison. He is, he's a hospice worker in the prison. He works as a nurse's aide. I mean, he takes care of the sick and dying inmates around him. He's quite an extraordinary guy, and he's the first of two in the history of the Connecticut prison system that actually earned a bachelor's degree while in a maximum security prison. So he's a really exceptional person who had a very exceptional set of circumstances that led him to murder, and he wasn't able to control his desire.
So what's the thesis on how he changed or rehabbed, or what, I don't know what the word you would use, I guess rehabbed in some regards, to be this kind of human?
Well, the thesis was, first of all, society did the right thing by taking him out of society because he wasn't able to control his emotions. And I'm very clear in the book, and I want to be clear here that, you know, describing somebody with some amount of understanding for their mental illness and with compassion is not the same as allowing them to have a defense to murder or to be not arrested and put away until they're completely safe. So that's not what I argue and advocate for here. But his journey in prison has been one of reclaiming his ability to control his revenge desires and understand that it turns out the other half of my book, or the other quarter, I guess, at the end, is about forgiveness as the other hardwired mechanism that we have inside our heads that is, you know, counters the desire for revenge by actually stopping the pain of grievances and stopping these revenge desires that can become compulsive and take over our lives. And so he's been able to do that. And I don't know if he'll get out earlier than at the end of his sentence, but certainly in prison, he's been exemplary.
So let's talk about forgiveness. I think gratitude, too, is something I see in this. And certainly when I talk to my friends in the behavioral science world, especially in dealing with issues like trauma and grief, the idea of being able to have gratitude for what you have in the moment and that. But also forgiveness. And this is, of course, a topic right now. Charlie Kirk's widow forgave the killer in a very powerful moment that I think transcends whatever your politics are. What is the power of forgiveness? And I think what I also want you to address is the fact that I think a popular narrative is somehow that means letting folks off the hook. And that's not what you're necessarily talking about.
No, it's not. Not at the brain biological level. So what we know from similar brain scans that not only looked at revenge seeking, but also looked at what happens inside your brain when you forgive, some truly amazing. Like if I could put this in a pill, I would be a multi-billionaire, a trillionaire right now. If I could sell you what forgiveness does, because what it does inside your brain is it actually goes to the pain network that was activated by your grievance, which is an area called the anterior insula. It shuts that down. It actually stops pain. Whereas revenge fantasies and revenge seeking gives you a rapid dopamine hit that doesn't last long, but it feels good. With forgiveness, it stops pain. I mean, isn't that what we are all looking for in most of our medications? What's the drug that will stop the pain, doc? Please give that to me and give it to me now. So that's one thing that forgiveness does. The second thing it does is it also stops the craving area of your brain, the nucleus accumbens and the dorsal striatum that are constantly causing you to ruminate and plan and plot and think about how can I get back at the person who wronged them. That suddenly shuts down. So you're instantly freed, at least for a moment, from these revenge cravings. And then the last thing that forgiveness does is it activates or reactivates your prefrontal cortex. That's your decision-making center, which is there to stop you from doing things that would hurt you or other people, the negative consequences part of all addictions. And it's believed that that center of your brain has been hijacked or otherwise immobilized in other forms of addiction. And it seems to be the case as well with revenge seeking, that your prefrontal cortex is silent when you're thinking about revenge. But forgiveness restores that, gives you better decision-making control. So in summary, you know, revenge is a wonder drug that actually truly works wonders. And unbelievably, you know, it's free. You don't need a prescription. You don't have to go to a doctor. You can get it anytime and take as much as you want. It doesn't have negative side effects. It has all of these benefits. But we're caught up in society with the idea that, oh, you're letting someone off the hook. Not so. When you forgive in this neurological way, you don't even have to talk to the person who wronged you. You're not condoning what they've done. You're not saying what they've done is okay. You're using it as a way of healing yourself foremost. Maybe later at some point you would want to extend some sort of offer of forgiveness to them and in an attempt to restore a relationship, that's valuable to you. And that's worth doing, but it's not required to get all of these neurological benefits. So I just highly recommend it. I'm so glad that you brought up Erica Kirk, the widow of Charlie Kirk. I mean, she brought that entire, everything I just said into one compressed moment in time and showed, you know, the country and the world, this can happen. It can even happen when we think that the other side, if you're a liberal person and you think, what happened to conservatives' belief in, you know, Jesus's ancient forgiveness teachings that have now have support in brain biology and neuroscience like I have. And I was so happy and delighted to see her bring that up and go, yes, it's still alive and it's still here. We can do this.
You know, so we've had a number of different scientists on the show in a variety of contexts to talk about these ideas. And we have upcoming guests. So the last two books I read are also playing around with these ideas, again, in different contexts. But it really, the thing that I keep coming away with was this idea that we all grew up with, that you can somehow take emotions out of the equation, has done a terrible number on us as humans. And it is permeated business. So it's in the business books, right? And they're now business people are figuring this out. You know, the army figured this out a while ago. They were dealing with positive psychology and other elements well before that was hitting corporate America, because lives were on the line.
Yeah.
And they are. Their lives are on the line every single day. Our lives for being happy or not happy or whatever. And so this idea that it makes so much sense that this, which seems extreme, is just another version of someone who can't let a negative emotion and pass through them, because we haven't given them the skills. We don't talk about it. We don't train for it. And yet, as you know in your life, because you talked about that, I know that in my life, because that story I told ain't the only story where I lost it. but as I grew, I grew practices that allowed me to breathe and take a beat. And you know, an improvisation is a huge part of that, because, you know, the whole rule in improvisation is, you know, my job when I'm improvising, when I have no script with the other person, is to save them. Their job is to save me. I build on what they're saying. They build on what I'm saying. Their reality is as real as my reality. And so working with Alzheimer's folks, working with hostage negotiation people, all the different, working with CEOs, all the different people we work with are very much the things that you are talking about with regard to how you treat a disease that is not new.
Right.
And you go so far as, I mean, you got a chapter on Hitler, Stalin, and Mao. So
I spent a lot of time having to dig through all three of their lives, the three greatest killers in the history of the world. And I found that they clearly, the evidence is they, all three of them were revenge addicts and revenge motivated throughout their entire, dictatorial murder sprees that they all three went on. So this is, and as you say, this goes, it's not only is it not new, it goes back to, you know, our earliest archetypal stories, you know, with Cain and Abel and the Great Flood, for instance. I mean, this is ancient stuff, because we have evolved to, you know, want revenge when we feel wronged. That is the evolutionary path, and that's the evolutionary card that we're dealt. But it doesn't mean it has to be a death sentence. We can absolutely intervene on that. And the idea of finally acknowledging that revenge seeking first is the root motivation for almost all forms of human violence, that's bullying on playgrounds to intimate partner violence and street and gang violence, mass shootings, you know, genocide and terrorism and war, all through there. That's all revenge motivated. And to see that that revenge desire is a brain biological process that we can intervene on by understanding it's an addictive type of process that involves craving and pleasure. And we have lots of tools in our toolkit already, the addiction toolkit, I'll call it, call them, to help people with other addictions that can be repurposed to help people control their revenge desires. And then on top of it, we were gifted by evolution with this other hardwired process called forgiveness that we can use to shut the entire thing down. And we need to start teaching our kids about the benefits of forgiveness, you know, at the earliest possible moment. Studies show that toddlers, you know, revenge desires begin in the toddler years. Just go to a toddler and take away their ice cream cone and watch the reaction. Okay, you're going to get some revenge seeking, and it's going to be pretty fast and sometimes pretty strong. So we can begin teaching forgiveness to help our children understand their revenge cravings and their victimization experiences and begin to control those and not harm themselves further and show them how to self-heal, which is what forgiveness is about.
So this feels like a good time for me to set you up to talk about your feelings about The Lion King.
Oh, a lot of grievances about The Lion King, man. Yeah, a lot of grievances. I mean, you're just triggering me bigly right now.
I know. I'm sorry.
I'm just about ready to launch it off of my chair.
But actually, I think it's a really great story, especially in contrast to Bambi. So actually, why don't you
I'm happy to do that. You know, The Lion King is such a hugely popular children's, what we think of as a children's movie, is a gore revenge fest. I mean, that is what the plot is. When you think about The Lion King, you've got to remember that it starts with, you know, Uncle Scar having a grievance because Simba's been born and now Scar's not going to make his way to the throne. And so he out of his grievance, he decides to retaliate against Simba and Mufasa, the king, by trying to kill Simba. And when he can't get that done, he actually kills Mufasa, Simba's dad, and then tries to kill Simba again, and Simba scampers away, you know, into another land and leaves. And so, you know, we've got Scar now king, what he wanted. He got what he wanted or what he thought he wanted. And then we go through the process as the plot continues. Well, let me just stop there for a second and go, So what happened in the audience? What are the filmmakers doing? They have wounded us to our core. They've given us perhaps the most painful grievance a human being can have, which is watching the death of a parent and being powerless and actually in the movie being accused of causing that death, which, you know, Simba was not responsible for it. It was Scar, but that's how Scar played it. And so having victimized us at the beginning of the movie, what do we want from that? The moment that Scar casts Mufasa off that cliff, we want Scar to be killed, and we want him to be killed in the most sadistic, powerful way that we can. You know, and the filmmakers know this. I interviewed a former head of Disney Studios for the book, and, you know, he acknowledged that that's what revenge plots are about. And we, you know, entertainment industry uses them always. Why? Because they always work. They never don't sell tickets. When we buy a lot of tickets to, let's say, superhero movies, we're like the Avengers, and the name says everything right there in the title. What we're looking for is, please victimize me at the beginning. Please give me some enormous dopamine hit at the end when we destroy the villain, and then let me walk free out of that theater feeling happy about that. That's what we're after. In other words, we're like drug addicts going to the dealer and asking for another hit. That's what we're doing.
All right. In a moment, I'm going to ask you for your yes and story. Before we do that, I'm taking us back to Hitler. Sorry, everyone, but I think this is really interesting. You thread the needle really deftly with regard to, first, where the Hitler grievance comes from. And you say, I've got the quote here, it's from Brendan Sims, who says, quote, "It was not the war that made Hitler, but the peace." And then where you end the book with the Marshall Plan, essentially. Yeah. So kind of take us through that, because I think that's you found a really nice way to sort of bridge this together with like ancient arcs of relatively recent history that also maybe explain the story.
Yeah, they do. And in that instance, you know, Hitler had been a soldier in World War One. He came out of that with the German armistice, and he and a lot of his colleagues who had sacrificed a lot of lives and endured a lot of hardships were very upset that Germany agreed to the armistice and ultimately the Treaty of Versailles. And the Treaty of Versailles placed the entire blame for World War I on Germany, and it punished Germany severely, so much so that the economist, the British economist, John Maynard Keynes, he, who was part of the negotiating team in arriving at the Treaty of Versailles, walked out because he realized that by punishing Germany so severely, we would be staging, essentially creating a new opportunity for a much bigger world war. And he predicted the whole thing. It's unbelievable. Yeah. He predicted it long before it happened. And that's exactly what occurred. What we didn't know at the time, what Hitler did, is that he saw the people who had negotiated the Treaty of Versailles on behalf of Germany, the politicians, and people on both sides, really, of the political spectrum, and particularly Jews, as having betrayed Germany in the process of negotiating the treaty and accepting all of these punitive terms. And he wanted revenge against all of them. He thought that they were all traitors, and that traitors deserved death. And that began, you know, a 30-year reign of terror that, you know, that Hitler perpetrated in his effort to build an entire societal system that would, in fact, punish the Jews, the politicians, and anyone who had anything to do with the Treaty of Versailles, and eventually the nations that were on the opposite side of that treaty, including all of the Allies and Russia. So that was World War II was an entire revenge-seeking, compulsive revenge-seeking conflagration. And it ended finally with an initial, you know, military conquest, as we all know. But that just stopped the hostilities, and that's what military conquests always do. They temporarily stop hostilities. The only thing that can hold the peace, it turns out, after even international conflict, is forgiveness. And that's what, you know, Harry Truman brought to America, was the idea, along with Churchill and Attlee Stevenson. They brought the idea that if we punish Germany again, and now Germany really, really, really deserved it after the Holocaust and everything else that they perpetrated, as well as the Japanese, at least in the eyes of the Allies, in all these cases. But if we would punish them again, which they deserved, we would be setting the stage for World War III, yet another round of revenge seeking. And so what if we did something shocking and unbelievable, and we actually forgave Germany and Japan and decided to help rebuild them? And that decision has gifted us with two of America's strongest allies now, Germany and Japan, and many decades, 80 years plus of peace. So forgiveness is not a Pollyanna-ish kind of concept. It works at international hard power scale, as well as at your individual scale in your home, with your kids, with your spouse, with your neighbors, you know, with your coworkers at work, you know, with all of the people around you and in your community, and including between liberals and conservatives. It can, does, should, and will work once we decide to use it again.
And it's very sobering to think that the Marshall Plan never would have happened in the age of social media.
I don't want to be that pessimistic and say it never would have, but it would have been a heck of a lot
so hard
right now. I mean, could we get a social plan today? Pretty much not. But I'm optimistic that we're going to eventually master our emotions and social media at the same time. Social media really is working against humanity right now by enabling all of us to spread our grievances to millions of other people at light speed and our desires for revenge, and begin to plot and fantasize about them online, and even use online mechanisms to plot and carry out revenge acts in the real world. So, you know, but that's new technology that just descended upon humanity in the last 20 years. We're going to take some time to adjust to that. But one way to adjust is to realize it is an extremely dangerous technology that is fueling revenge craving behaviors among, and I'll stick with the liberal conservative dialectic here for a moment, among those two groups at light speed every day, 24/7.
Yeah, there was literally a study I saw this morning that's like, by far, most Americans don't want the garbage that's being thrown around that this is a war and that there should be political revenge, by far. And we know from the data that these extremists get the algorithm favors them, and it's drowning out the basically most of the behavior we see when we walk around in the world.
Yeah. And you know, let's not, I mean, it is extreme, but maybe that's a pejorative term. Now let's think about the people who are doing this as people who are really revenge addicted people, right?
Yeah.
And they need, and so the idea is help them. Don't try and crush them. You're not going to crush half of the country. I don't care which side you're on. You're not going to be able to crush the other half. But you could help and love the other half and bring the entire thing back down again into a peaceful, wonderful nation state again, which I think is what both sides actually want. Let's do it.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. We always end the podcast with a yes and story. Yeah. What you got for us?
So my yes and story is this book. My wife and I talk all the time. This is a book, The Science of Revenge, that I wrote that I absolutely did not want to write. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to have anything to do with it. I didn't want to spend years researching these, you know, revenge desires and what happens. I didn't want to give my life over to that. It sounded too depressing. It sounded too unhelpful to my own situation when I was trying to control my own revenge desires. And even though I was fascinated by the powerful science that shows what's going on, I really thought other people, maybe one or more of the neuroscientists around the world who were doing the basic research brain scan studies, one of them would be better off writing this book. And none of them, not a single one, was willing to come to the fore and go, I'm going to go public with this. There is a thing called revenge addiction. We have evidence of it now, and this can change everything about human violence and, you know, human destruction of relationships. So I did a yes and. And the and was, and I did this with my publisher, it was kind of like, I will study and I will write the revenge side of this. And if I can also write the forgiveness side of the story and research that. And I was delighted. I sort of put that on. That was sort of the candy at the end of this long journey that I was like, I can't wait to get there. But I'll have to spend a couple of years with the worst people in the world, mass shooters and dictators. But I knew at the end, I'd get a chance to actually hardcore research what forgiveness is about. And by giving it that much time, it turned out that the neuroscientists had done this forgiveness research and it was ready at the moment I needed it. I couldn't believe it. And so, if you look in this book on the neuroscience of forgiveness is absolutely remarkable. It's so hopeful. It just made the book end in just the right way, which is on an up note of this can get better and it will. I think all societies, like all individuals, go through cycles of revenge seeking and I feel so good, I'm going to keep doing it. And then we finally get control of it and we settle it down and then we do it again. But we can maybe make those periods of calm and peace longer with some of this information.
It's so good. The book is called The Science of Revenge, Understanding the World's Deadliest Addiction and How to Overcome It. James Kimmel Jr., thank you for coming on the pod.
Kelly, thanks so much for having me.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Aridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.